Well, good morning. Can you believe a new year is here? 2022.
Looking forward to it for about 8 months.
8 months. Yes, sir. Couldn't come too fast for you. Do we write checks anymore? Anybody write checks? Supposed to, yeah. Don't forget to change the date on your check. It's getting to be a thing of the past, I guess. People do other things to pay their bills. Well, it's good to pay bills is a thing of the past. Yes. Good luck with that. Good to have Rachel Ward with us this morning. Looks like the rest of the family has run off and left you, but you're here, and all of you, welcome. Well, we were almost late for church this morning because our doors were froze shut in the truck. Yeah, so I got in, but the girls couldn't, so I didn't want to leave them. I managed to get them open. So those vast swaps in temperature following a rain can cause problems. Unless you have your vehicle in a garage, which is handy. Well, we're studying in Isaiah this morning, and the next chapter that we're going to look at is chapter 13. Which begins a new section in Isaiah. You notice here the first verse starts with the burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amoz did see. And so I'll start with, I'm going to read a little bit from Moyer's commentary as he describes the structure of this section of the book. He entitles chapters 13 through 27 as the universal kingdom. So what we'll see throughout this section is Isaiah turning his gaze somewhat away from the immediate surroundings of Judea and Jerusalem, although they do come up, and looking at the larger world picture. And there was a lot going on in this world around Judea. And they were kind of caught in the middle of some major things. He says, this new section of Isaiah continues to focus on the king in Zion. It is sometimes expressed in terms of the city, sometimes in terms of the Davidic king or of the Lord's reign in Zion, and is a natural sequence of chapters. I think he means it follows naturally from chapter 6 through 12. In that section, Isaiah's leading concern was to show the triumph of divine grace for Judah and Israel, whereby the Lord would bring back a remnant of his people, redeemed and rejoicing, into the realm of the perfect divine king of David's line. But there was more to it than that, for Isaiah had a world vision, a messianic kingdom, extending in peace to the utmost limits of space and time, a renewed world. And the intriguing idea of a world gathering wider than the national Israel of the Exodus, capable of being described as the remnant of his people. The particular needs of chapters 6 through 12 permitted no more than a sidelong glance at the universalism of the Lord's royal plans. And it falls to the present section to open them up more fully. This is, in fact, a feature of the structure of Isaianic literature, that the hints of one section become the leading theme of the next. Just as the Davidic hints in chapters 1 through 5 grow into the full-length portrait of the coming David of chapters 6 through 12. So, the universalistic allusions in chapters 6 through 12 develop into a worldview in chapters 13 through 27. Okay, so he continues to talk about that. And he says that these chapters that we are going to read consist of 10 oracles. Okay, and an oracle tends to be phrased in terms of the burden which Isaiah did see. Okay, that expression is the way Isaiah labels these visions or oracles that he received. The first five are given specific titles relating to identifiable historical peoples. So the first one is Babylon. We know about Babylon, and that's a easily identifiable place and people. Whereas the second five have four enigmatic titles, which in context can be identified with particular peoples, and one plain title in chapter 23. Okay, so two sets of five, total of 10. And here he lists them side by side. In the first set, we'll look at Babylon, Philistia, or the land of the Philistines, Moab, Damascus / Israel, and Egypt. And then the second five, which are not so clearly identified, but which he says are identifiable from the context, are again Babylon, and then Edom, Arabia, Jerusalem, and finally the city of Tyre on the Mediterranean coast, just slightly to the north of the land of Israel. Formally, each list begins with Babylon, and the oracle dealing with the Lord's people comes forth. But the balance of the list goes beyond four. The two Babylon oracles deal respectively with the political and religious downfall of the city. The first is full of kings and armies, while the latter refers only to idols. The first specifies that all is for the sake of Israel, while the second brings news of the fall of Babylon as a message of comfort to crushed Israel. The Philistia and Edom oracles share a forward look, the former to a coming supremacy of the house of David, and the latter recording the message of time, the passage of time, without any clear end terminus. The Moab and Arabia articles both concern Gentile fugitives seeking succor. Moab looks for help to Zion, but is inhibited from finding it by its own pride. And Gentile tribes attempt mutual support, but gain no enduring security. The fourth pair reveals the people of God looking for help other than in the Lord and His Word. Israel in a Gentile alliance, and Jerusalem in self-salvation. Finally, for both Egypt and Tyre, there is a remarkable ultimate turning to the Lord. Other lines of connection bind the five pairs together, but this suffices to indicate the general structuring of the double series. Okay, so that's a general description of the coming chapters 13 through 27. Now, in this one, chapter 13, the oracle is the topic of Babylon. Let's talk about Babylon a little bit before we read this oracle. Babylon was a great city, possibly the largest city in the ancient world. During this period and a little bit later, it is thought to have had as many as 200,000 residents, which pales compared to our modern big cities, the largest of which I think is Tokyo, Japan, with 37 million. But it's still a lot of people and a big departure from a farm community. 200,000 is a lot of folks. Babylon went through a long series of changes in leadership. And it's easy in your mind to think, okay, here's Babylon. You got the Babylonians. That's clearly identified. But there were different people groups that ruled the city over time. And it was destroyed numerous times. However, it seems to have been recognized as a center of art, culture, and religion. And so it had a special place on the map in people's minds as being a city of importance, a city of power. We find that the term Babylon and the city of Babylon shows up even in the book of Revelation. And interpreters of prophecy have done various things with the combined information we have from the Bible. Isaiah here, we will find, describes a Babylon which ends up totally desolate in the habitation of wild animals. And so some modern commentators have looked at Revelation and said, ah, Babylon must be going to be rebuilt in order for the fall described in Revelation to occur. And then there's also the problem that the description we have here in chapter 13, where Isaiah mentions the Medes being the people, primary people group who come against them. The primary picture here is this: is that of utter destruction. And yet we know from history that whenever Cyrus the Great, who was a Persian, Persians and Medes were allied at some point, when he took Babylon, he didn't destroy it. And it continued to be inhabited in some form, at some level, until 1000 AD. It just kind of faded away. And so then that's why some would say, well, okay, it has to be rebuilt in order to be destroyed in this cataclysmic fashion. But the picture ends up being more complicated than that. And speaking of pictures, let's look at a few pictures because pictures are great to keep people awake and can save a lot of talking, I've been told. So to add 1,000 words to our discussion this morning, let's look at this picture. Not that one yet. So this is an artist's rendition of the overview of Babylon. And from a military standpoint, it was a very defensible city. You see the River Euphrates runs through the middle of it. There's moats around the sides. There were walls, which by the time of Nebuchadnezzar, sorry, this version of slides doesn't allow me to advance when I want, were as much as 40 feet high, were so wide on the top that Herodotus claims they had chariot races on top of the walls. So it wasn't an easy city to take by the time of Nebuchadnezzar, which, of course, is still in the future of Isaiah. In the future of Isaiah. Okay. Right. So, in fact, this city was destroyed and rebuilt before Nebuchadnezzar came to power. So, there's an overall view. This is another artist's rendition of the Ishtar Gate, a famous gate on the north. And you can see some a famous ziggurat or temple structure there in the background. By the time we get to modern times, it looked more like this. And so this pretty much matches Isaiah's description. It just took a long time to get there. Now, it's interesting, during the days of Saddam Hussein, he was totally fascinated by the history of Babylon and proceeded to try to restore it. He built a palace for himself at the top of one of the mounds. You can see a picture of it there, where he hosted great meals and all. There were some, these pictures don't show them. I don't know if I got it. A lot of the, he started rebuilding walls as well and structures. Yeah. This is the remains, part of the remains, at least, of the famous Ishtar Gate. It happens to be located in Berlin, Germany. At the end of World War I, the British came into possession of the area, and the German archaeologists working there smuggled this out, brick by brick. And built it back in Berlin. But I wanted to, we're going to compare this. Saddam did a reconstruction on a smaller scale. And to get the sense of the scale, notice the size of the people. How many people are in that gate there? There's several. It's about 38 feet tall. And so then Saddam came along. And from this angle, it looks like he really did something big, although the bricks are just painted instead of glazed. But when we see it in perspective of people, we see that Saddam's gate wasn't nearly as big as the original. It'd be a tight squeeze for as many people as we saw on that other one. Now here's a couple shots inside of Saddam's palace, since he no longer is in power. This was once a lavish area, and currently is a place to lounge and paint. So, how the mighty do fall. So, I had a few more facts here, I think, about the city that I just wanted to mention. Now, I mentioned the fact that it had a long history, many rulers. The most famous of which was Hammurabi. You may have studied in school about the law of Hammurabi. And that was in Babylon that he ruled. But it wasn't until after the time of Isaiah, Nebuchadnezzar fortified the city with three rings of walls that were 40 feet tall. And the area that it encircled was about 200 square miles, roughly the size of Chicago today. So that's quite an effort. That shrine to Marduk stood about 280 feet tall, about the size of a 26-story office building. And all this was done by Nebuchadnezzar and his immediate predecessors in a fairly short time, because the city of Babylon was destroyed totally by Sennacherib, who also was the one who besieged Jerusalem under Hezekiah. Okay, so during the time of Sennacherib, he claims to have, well, let me just read it to you here, what Sennacherib claims he did to Babylon. He says, the city and its houses, from foundation to roof, I destroyed them, I demolished them, I burned them with fire. Walls, gateways, sacred chapels, and towers of earthen tiles, I laid them low and cast them into the Arachtu, which is what he calls the river Euphrates. So that means you had to start over, right? That's pretty thorough destruction we're talking there. And it's interesting that you remember Sennacherib, he suffered assassination at the hands of his own sons after it was actually the same year that he besieged Jerusalem that he did this to Babylon. And a few years later, maybe closer to 9, he was assassinated in his own country while he was worshiping his gods by two of his sons. And the Babylonians felt like this was divine retribution for the destroying their city. So it was a very short time in which this city was rebuilt then into the grandeur that we see in these pictures and these remains. So that's a sort of a snapshot of the history. And let's go back and read Isaiah's words here. His burden of Babylon. He says, "Lift up a banner upon the high mountain, exalt a voice unto them, shake the hand, that they may go into the gates of the nobles." Okay, so this is the ancient way sort of saying, this is a top story, give it the headline, goes to the front page, this is important, proclaim this everywhere. "I have commanded my sanctified ones, I have also called my mighty ones for mine anger, even them that rejoice in my highness. The noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people." And I always find the images interesting. I've always been a person who's fairly sensitive to sounds. That's not bothering me, if I'm sometimes I'm sitting studying in my room, my bedroom, and I hear a low rumble, and I'm like, okay, did somebody just start a tractor up the sawmill? Is it the garbage truck? Is it Rachel? what is that? Her truck makes a little more noise now than it used to. Certain sounds are very disturbing to me. I run a lot of heavy equipment, and they're supposed to sound a certain way. Each machine has its own peculiar sounds, and if it starts doing certain kinds of sounds, some sounds, it's like, okay, it needs grease. Other sounds, it's like, I'm getting off of here. This is not good. And so you become more sensitive to those things as you get experience. And so these kind of sounds, can you imagine in the ancient world the contrast between the everyday sounds, perhaps the agricultural sounds, the noises of the animals in the trees and the forest around you or the meadow, and then the sound of a mighty army moving. And you realize that's serious. And where do I go now? Right? There's no escape. You know, there's huge distances that separated these people. But, you know, the Assyrian army during this period was even making trips down to Egypt. It conquered Egypt, at least the southern or the northern Egypt. That's a long ways to pack bows and arrows and chariots and food and all those things. I mean, we have trouble with logistics now. You know, it's one thing to get your tanks on the front line, but if you don't have fuel and ammunition, you got problems. Well, imagine the supply chain in the ancient world that went from northern Mesopotamia to Egypt. But so it's easy once they're back home and you just have a local provincial governor over you, it's easy to feel like, let's rebel. They're a long ways off. We got at least 6 months. Let's live high for 6 months. But whether you think that or not, whenever you realize they're here, they're coming, the sound is very disturbing. And so the noise of a multitude in the mountains, like as of a great people, the tumultuous noise of the kingdoms of nations gathered together. The Lord of hosts mustereth the host of the battle. So Isaiah here is continuing to picture God as in control of the course of history. He's the one who has called together these nations who are making changes in the map. They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord, and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. Howl ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It shall come as a destruction from the Almighty. Therefore shall all hands be faint, and every man's heart shall melt. They shall be afraid. And of course, this is his burden, his oracle for Babylon. He's saying, this is what's coming to you. Pangs and sorrows shall take hold of them. They shall be in pain as a woman that travaileth. They shall be amazed one at another. Their faces shall be as flames. Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate, and he shall destroy the sinners thereof out of it. For the stars of heaven and the constellations thereof shall not give their light. The sun shall be darkened in his going forth, and the moon shall not cause her light to shine. Okay, now that's a passage that we have referenced when we were studying Matthew. You remember in Matthew 24 that this metaphoric imagery was used to describe the coming darkness that would encompass the land of Judah with the destruction of Jerusalem. And we see a sort of stock prophetic language. In some ways, in the best of times, the leaders of a nation give it light, give it a direction, give it the ability to see the path forward. In the best of days. At any rate, for any nation, the disintegration of that nation can be easily likened to a time of darkness for the people. As much as we like to feel like we're independent from the goings-on in Washington and Springfield and other places, the fact is our life becomes very difficult whenever there is dysfunction at that level. If there isn't somebody taking care of the supply chain, somebody who at least knows what it is, then life can get very complicated, no matter how independent you feel or would like to be. If you cannot buy the things that you need to do your work, it's a problem. It's hard to make your own steel from iron ore, you know? It's hard to grow all your own food. And imagine making your own medicine. Right? It's been done before, but it totally changes the way life looks. And so I can see easily why this metaphor of the sun being darkened, the moon not shining, are a very poignant way of describing the destruction of leadership and the structure of culture. And so here he uses that metaphor. He says, I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease and lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. I will make a man more precious than fine gold. Okay, so what is it that makes fine gold so precious? There's not much of it, right? It's scarce. I mean, in the end, what does the average person do with it? You know, you can't eat it. You probably don't build your house with it. It's heavy. What good is it? Except we say, oh, there's not very much of that. I'm going to get some before it runs out, which makes it valuable. So the picture here is of people being scarce. There will be so many destroyed. So even a man, then the golden wedge of Ophir. Therefore I will shake the heavens, and the earth shall remove out of her place in the wrath of the Lord of hosts, and in the day of his fierce anger. And it shall be as the chaste roe, which was a deer, and as a sheep that no man taketh up. They shall every man turn to his own people, and flee every man to his own land. Every one that is found shall be thrust through, and every one that is joined unto them shall fall by the sword. Their children also shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes. Their houses shall be spoiled, their wives ravished. Behold, I will stir up the Medes against them, which shall not regard silver, and as for gold, they shall not delight in it. Which is a way of saying you can't buy them off. They were happy to collect the gold, and did in great quantities, but you couldn't buy them off. Their bows also shall dash the young men to pieces, and they shall have no pity on the fruit of the womb. Their eyes shall not spare children. In Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldees' excellency, shall be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. Neither shall the Arabian pitch tent there, neither shall the shepherds make their fold there. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures. And owls shall dwell there, and satyrs shall dance there. And the wild beasts of the islands shall cry in their desolate houses, and dragons in their pleasant places. And her time is near to come, and her days shall not be prolonged. So, this is Isaiah's record of what he saw coming for Babylon, a city of great historic importance, a city which would be destroyed totally before it again rose to be the home of the peoples that would destroy Jerusalem. But he says, in the future, at some point, it shall be as we saw in the picture, a desolate place. Now, I think it's fair to notice here that his real concern throughout all this is not to exactly spell out the coming events for Babylon, as it is to say that God is the one who is in control of this. And even though here's a city which in your mind is an icon of greatness, an icon of what it means to be successful on earth, to be powerful, to be blessed, and yet they are a mere footnote in history compared to what God is doing and how God is moving.
It's kind of, well, it's not kind of, it's a really bleak picture.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't have hope outside of this life, because, like, if this is what happens to the big cities, and you can't surrender, because they'll just kill you anyway, you gotta fight for it, but if you fight, then they really want to kill you. or make you slaves and kill your family. But if you leave town beforehand, if you're out on your own, then any band of wandering robbers or thieves could take you out.
Yes.
And there's just where do you go, what do you do? You could very quickly lose, you know, your family could be broken up or watch them killed. It's a horrible, horrible picture.
Yes.
And yet that was a very common picture back then.
Uh-huh.
It seems.
Yes, and you know, Isaiah is promoting throughout all this a faith in God, the God of Israel, the God who is ultimately in control of history. He connects the events, the evil of these things, to the evil of man. He speaks here of God particularly pursuing the sinners. Verse 9, he shall destroy the sinners that are out of it. Verse 11, I will punish the world for their evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will cause the arrogancy of the proud to cease and will lay low the haughtiness of the terrible. So it is an oracle which is intended to dispel from your mind any sense that there is security in the great spectacle of a great city like Babylon. As incredibly elevated as they have made themselves at this point, it says their houses are going to be inhabited by doleful creatures.
Homes.
Yes, and satyrs.
Ostriches and jackals is what my translation says.
Okay.
What were satyrs?
Jackals.
Wild goats. Hyenas, jackals.
Satyrs are sylvan demigods. They're half man, half goat. They're believed by the Arabs to haunt these ruins, probably animals of the goat ape species, devil worshippers who dance amid the ruins on a certain night.
Do they make good pets?
Depends on what neighborhood you're
in. Oh, I see. So if you need an attack dog, maybe, huh? But certainly not the kind of a creature that you would want in your house if you were thinking of building one in a great place like Babylon. Yeah.
That makes you remind you of the story that Jesus told about the straw man in the house.
Yeah.
That when you clean it out and you don't put anything worthwhile inside, it gets overrun by all the garbage. Seven times as much. You know, this sounds what this sounds like.
Spiders and varmints.
And it's just so ironic that Saddam tried to build something. Look at it now.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he was going to restore Babylon.
Well, what's worse is America's often been called the new Babylon.
No. No. And we should be able to see that if we couldn't before.
And those kinds of atrocities still happen today, but overall the world condemns them. And I would argue because of the influence of Christianity, we have a mindset that says that that's not right. Whereas before, that was kind of what happened, and then if you got your chance, you do it back to them. It just, that was life.
Yes, indeed.
He brought a standard of justice, didn't he? And maybe the Jews had a certain amount of, I mean, we know from what God taught them that there was a certain amount.
Okay, well, we're out of time by my clock, and so we will move on to another oracle next week. Actually, this extends into chapter 14 as well. So, okay.
Sunday by the traditional church calendar, so the wise men coming to see Jesus, and I've tried to focus on my part on light and the analogy of his light in the darkness. And I have heard so many people talk about how they feel like we as a nation are in a dark time, and in the world are in a dark time, and so the analogy is even more encouraging to think about Jesus being the light that shows us the way through the darkness. This song I heard on the Geddes Evensong album is called Keep Letting the Light In. And it's kind of a lullaby. It's from a mother's perspective of her little child. I often have sung it to Ellie as she sat on my lap when I have her on Thursdays. And I guess with Ellie, I've been at a different stage of my life, and so I can see further back and farther in, you might say, and just recognizing that every little life that comes into this world has so much potential for good or for evil. And if I'm given the privilege of being a part of a little life, I want to do my best to influence that child to choose Jesus, to choose the light, to let the light in. And I would pray that each one of us, even on, you know, as you get older, you got to keep letting the light in. I've got to keep letting the light in. So it's for all of us, even though it is from a mother's perspective or adopted grandmother.
Stars danced when you were born. The moon smiled sky. Then with your first sunrise, the light poured in your eyes. So little did you know how quickly Whispering in